Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferron Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the EML team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Our burning questions for today are, what is Green Card Voices? And what are the intended outcomes from sharing the website and the book? And here to respond to my questions is my very special guest, Teja Rosman. Teja, welcome.
Thank you for having me. And yes, my name is Teja, and I was born and raised in Yugoslavia. I came to the United States at the age of 20. And I was always, immersed in this environment here in the United States, and also knew that people are very curious and wanted to know about immigrants. But at the same time, there was a lot of also backlash against immigrants and refugees in some communities. So in 2014, a group of us, immigrants, educators, refugees, came together, and we decided to create a platform where immigrants and refugees can share stories in a way that stories are considered, a gift to a community and are very respectful to those people sharing them. And the whole story collecting happens in a trauma-informed process. Mm-hmm. And the publication or amplification of these stories happens for a reason, with a purpose, and that is to benefit the community as a whole, so that immigrants and refugees can feel like they belong and they are co-creating inclusive communities free of xenophobia and hate crimes.
I'm very happy that you're able to join me today.
Yes, my pleasure. Again, we create, so-called hyper-local projects. And while our headquarters of the organization is in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we've done now various projects in 5 different states, including New York State. And we had amazing collaboration with 4 high schools in Rochester and Buffalo. I'm extremely happy that you invited me and that I can talk more about the project and our work.
So you talked a little bit about how you got started in 2014. I didn't realize that it's been this long, because the first I had heard about it is when you worked with Jen Rapponi in Rochester. So it's very interesting to know that that you've worked with so many different states and so many different projects within this. It's just an amazing project. So I think you kind of alluded to how it got started. Mm-hmm. So where are you now? How has it changed from the beginning, and where are you now? What are you working on?
Yes. So, we recorded 500 stories of immigrants and refugees coming from around 140 countries around the world. And we, like I said, now worked in 5 different states, East, West Coast, also in Atlanta, Georgia, as well as Midwest, so different corners of the United States. During COVID, it was really hard to travel and do projects in high schools the way we have gotten used to. So during COVID, we started a couple of new book projects that we've since completed, and they've received a lot of success. It's graphic novels, where we sort of used stories that we recorded, and we partnered with immigrant and refugee illustrators to illustrate those stories. Mm-hmm. So we've been doing that. But now that, schools are open again, we have gone back to the previous model, which is so beloved. Yeah. And we are currently in the middle of our project, which is again going to be an anthology of 30 stories. But this time around, we didn't do it with this hyper-local context where, we would go to a city and record stories of diverse immigrants and refugees. Mm-hmm. But we instead decided to dedicate an entire book of 30 stories to one population of refugees coming from one country only, and that is Afghanistan.
Okay.
So it's a project that we've been working on for now over 6 months.
Okay.
We've completed recording So we have recorded 30 stories, partnered with, again, three different high schools. We are very intentional to make sure that we have girls and boys, that we have different ethnic groups, Pashtun, Hazara, Tajik, Uzbek, different, you know, representing different groups in Afghanistan. We were working for the first time with interpreters, which in the past wasn't the case, but we were working both with Dari or, you know, Farsi interpreters and interpreters for Pashto speakers. Mm-hmm. So the interviews were done both in English and their native language, which is a nice twist. And yeah, we're just really excited and happy. That book's coming out in May. And yeah, it's, you know, as the years have gone on, we've learned so many things. And, you know, as you know, when American troops left Afghanistan, Taliban took over, and it was a big change for the people. Yes. And a lot of people had to flee. So one thing that is common to a lot of states in the United States that they are seeing Afghan refugees. And we're like, we really want to make sure that we try and capture those voices and publish a book so that it can be useful to educators as soon as possible, you know, not wait again. Right. But we really believe in, you know, prevention work and getting those stories out to as many hands. So yeah, we're really grateful to have found amazing partners in schools, but also a nonprofit organization called Afghan Cultural Society, which is Afghan-led organization that we have partnered with. They have been essential in leading this work with us. Like I said, stories are extremely powerful.
Yes.
We are expecting more refugees from Afghanistan in the coming future. So we're really grateful that we can do this work.
So are you working with the students from Afghanistan in Minneapolis, or are you in another state?
Yeah, this time around, we have decided just to stay a little bit closer to home.
Gotcha.
Just, you know, because as you know, COVID is not just totally gone. So yes, we have decided to initially work with Afghan students from throughout Minnesota. But once we got the data, the 95% of them are in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So then we selected two largest high schools with the largest Afghan population in Minneapolis, and then one high school with the largest Afghan population in St. Paul, which is the capital of Minnesota. So we work with those two cities.
Mm-hmm. And so if you were to recommend these materials or the books and the website, because you have a lot of these stories are posted to your website as well.
Yes.
How would you recommend that these materials be used in schools?
Yeah. So, you know, even when we publish books, it's very important to know that they're multimedia books because they have a full page color photograph or portrait of the storyteller. Then they have a written essay, which is based on the oral history recording that we do with students. It's in first person, so it's their work. And then we have a link 5-minute story where we sort of take that whole recording, we edit it down to 5 minutes to capture the pivotal points in their story. And we add a lot of photos as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, teachers can actually go on our website and they have access to, you know, almost 500 stories, 5-minute long stories. So they can show video, they can take excerpts or the whole essays from the books. We also have curriculum, you know, on the website that they can use. So yeah, there's very different way. We even created a story stitch, which is a conversation card game. So they can use the card game or various prompts to encourage their own students to share similar stories or, you know, life experiences and connect more deeply through shared experience that way as well.
I think it's helpful for English language learners, right? And immigrants that come to the country to, you know, reinforce and empower their voice, but it's also a good way to change perspective and see a different perspective as well. So I think these are really valuable resources, and I thank you so much for doing this work. It's intense, I'm sure, to listen to all of these stories but also be encouraged by their resilience as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot, you know, but we are trained professionals and we know how to hold space while at the same time do self-care. Mm-hmm. But our priority always is that, you know, for the people sharing their story, that they do it in a way that is trauma-informed, and we provide services or resources rather for them.
Yeah.
So that they walk away more empowered and that they are stronger as a result of sharing their story. So we're very, very focused on that.
I wonder, with the influx of Ukrainian population entering the United States, do you have any plans to do a project for Ukrainian students as well?
Yeah, that is something that we are talking about. That is something that's on our radar. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
We're not sure yet.
All right, great. Well, Taya, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. And thank you for sharing your work and your stories. And we look forward to your many more projects in the future.
Thank you so much.
Also joining us today is Jennifer Rapponi, who is a resource specialist in one of our sister ARBRNs in the Midwest region in Rochester. She's going to talk about her work with Dr. Rosman and the Green Card Voices Project. Jen? Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Jen, what is your role in the Green Card Voices?
So, I was lucky enough to attend International TESOL when it was held in Atlanta. I actually presented that year. And Green Card Voices was pretty prominent at that conference. So when you walked in the main sort of building, there were these lovely banners with QR codes with student stories, and then they had a table set up in the exhibition hall with books. And so I had been introduced to the project kind of that way, through the exhibition hall and the banners. And I noticed that there was a presentation being given by this publishing company that was featuring students, and I didn't know very much about it. But you know, my role as an ARBRN person, I very much feel like my major responsibility is to advocate for students. And so I finished one presentation completely on the other side of the campus and ran as fast as I could over, because I just had a feeling it would be a really well-attended and very powerful presentation. And it was. So it was a presentation of Taya and a higher ed partner that they were working with in Georgia. And then I believe two or three of the students that were featured in the Green Card Voices Atlanta book, reading their story, telling their process. And I was just blown away. And so after the present, and there was not a dry eye in the room either. And actually I'm getting choked up thinking about it. So, part of the promotional materials for the Green Card Voices Upstate New York book is a book trailer that I cannot watch without crying. And I've probably seen it 50 times. Because the resilience of these students is just so deeply powerful and moving. And I was privileged enough to watch the making of the book. So so afterwards, I approached her. I was actually with a teacher that I work pretty regularly with. She is from a mid-sized suburb, and they just got some of their first SCIFE students. So she was actually co-presenting with me. And we just looked at each other, and we were like, we have to find a way to make this happen in our region. So I approached Taya, and Kristen said, I would love to volunteer to be one of your sites. And I said, I can find the money to make this happen, or at least part of the money to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And part of the mission of Green Card Voices is to bring forth stories of immigrants in places that have had historic discrimination or current discrimination. And that was going on in our community at the time. You know, we were having, as well as many other places in the United States, growing anti-immigrant sentiment. Yeah. And we had just, in the city of Rochester, had a very, very large influx, the largest in New York State, of displaced peoples from Hurricane Maria. And we just didn't know what to do with them. Like, we didn't have the housing capacity. We didn't have the educational capacity. So many families were living in hotel rooms. The social services were great. They all kind of rallied around and did these one-stop shop things and, you know, really helped people get hooked up with jobs and food and transportation and more stable places to live. But if and how these students were integrated into the community was just very much a crapshoot. And so actually, the city of Rochester created a special newcomer academy for them called the Bilingual Language and Literacy Academy, which is featured in the book. So after many planning talks with Taya, we decided that it would be best to represent our students regionally. So you know from being from Syracuse that upstate New York has a very similar immigrant profile, and Rochester, Syracuse, Utica, and Buffalo. So we decided to partner with our Buffalo colleagues, Mike Duffy, and the schools that he had access to. So we did two schools in Rochester. So we did Brighton Middle School, which the lovely teacher Kristen Halligan helped with. We did the Bilingual Language and Literacy Academy in Rochester, which we partnered with Jill Harris to tell the stories of kids that were displaced from Hurricane Maria, which is really a first for us. You know, Rochester has a long and historic Puerto Rican community that doesn't get a lot of community attention media-wise for whatever reason. So there's a lot of stories about refugee integration and refugee schools, and but for whatever reason, our Puerto Rican community doesn't always get that notice and recognition, and they had really just survived historic, you know, trauma and natural disaster, and some kids lost everything, their house, their pets, their everything, and they just took the clothes on their back and hopped on a plane and came where their community was, where their family was, where people could help them start over. And so we were very lucky to be able to do that. And then the Buffalo schools were the immigrant schools that were housed at Lafayette. So Lafayette International High School and Lafayette Newcomer Academy. And so I think we try, part of the mission of Green Card Voices, we tried to get a range of students from hopefully representing most continents, many language groups, and then a range of students in varying degrees of immigration status. So we have a couple of kids who won the green card lottery, whose families won the green card lottery, which is just, it's statistically like winning the actual lottery.
Right.
And, you know, happened to have some distant relatives that lived in our region that they ended up living with. And, you know, their parents go from being, you know, professionals in their country to working at Dunkin' Donuts.
Yep.
And are so grateful for the opportunity to have their children have access to the education and the opportunities that America offers. It's just mind-blowing.
And I just want to clarify too, yeah, that before you got started here in Rochester and Buffalo, Taya was doing this work in Minneapolis, right? Minnesota.
Yes. So there are several Green Card Voices book published volumes. And the first one started in Minneapolis. So that's where she lives. That's where the not-for-profit began. Yeah. And, you know, big things have come out of the publishing of those books. Kids can take it as an opportunity to springboard themselves into kind of whatever it is that they want. Many of the students use their Green Card Voices essays for their college essays. Mm-hmm. So there's a student who's featured in our book, Esma Akutan, who is from Turkey, and she is currently attending Yale University. Mm-hmm. And plans on majoring in something related to child refugee rights, maybe an immigration lawyer, things like that. And Esma took this opportunity and used it to better her community, or will use it to better her community in the future. We're incredibly proud of her. There's another student that we worked with, a teenage girl from Yemen, who is the first literate female in her family.
Wow.
And it, like, I just being in the book is, has been incredibly special for all of these students. And I think why I was so attracted to the process and was really willing to do whatever it took to give the students in our region an opportunity is because it's the only book I know, only book series or publishing house that I know of whose sole mission is to lift immigrant voices and have those people be able to speak for themselves. There's a lot of speaking for other people that goes on in our society, a lot of other people telling the stories of immigrants that, you know, to varying degrees of authenticity and correctness. And so, you know, the goal is to have these students speak for themselves. And the second thing that is so special about this is language is not a barrier here. So not being having near native like fluency in English is not a barrier. So the process of creating this book is very much a best practice process for how we interact with English language learners in general. So the teachers that and the students that agree to this publishing process get given a series of 5 or 6 prompts that they are able to practice over and over and over again before they ever even meet Taya. So Taya comes out, meets the kids, gives the spiel. She usually brings another student author with her, and we were lucky enough that she brought one of the original authors from the Minneapolis book with her, and she was able to speak about this process from a student perspective. So she presented to each of the various groups, many students, and then students got to decide whether or not they wanted to participate. And I would say on average, half of the students that heard the spiel wanted to be a part of the book and half didn't. And that is also fine, right?
Yeah, right.
And then they get given this list of prompting questions with which they practiced in writing, they practiced orally. They told her multiple times over and over again. So when the day came to sort of do the process of the writing, quote unquote, they were ready. They'd done all of this oral rehearsal. They'd done all of this thinking about what and how they wanted to share their story in the clearest way possible. And so what Taya does that's also incredibly unique is that this begins as an oral storytelling project. So she brings a camera crew, and that camera crew sets up, and the kids come and sit down, and Taya interviews them. And so they've practiced, they know what's coming, and they are sharing orally. And then in English or in their home language. So we had a couple of students that went back and forth between those things. Mm-hmm. And one student that really only wanted to speak in Spanish, and it was fine.
Yeah.
So they spoke in Spanish, and the questions were asked in English. Taya did some follow-up, and then the oral interviews were then transcribed. So they were transcribed in whatever language was available to that student. Each of those videos then gets cut to about a 5-minute sort of storytelling segment that's posted on the Green Card Voices website.
Mm-hmm.
And then that student's story becomes a personal essay, essentially, in the book. So this process is in depth. It took many, many, many partnerships. So Taya had a partnership with Baruch College in New York City to do the actual transcribing. And then at the time, I was teaching a graduate course at SUNY Brockport, and I offered my students the possibility in exchange for another project. So they didn't have to do the project, they participated in this project, where they went and met with students and brought them their transcripts, read them out loud to them, asked them what they liked, what they wanted to change, what they wanted to keep. Kids were 100% in control of their own stories. There are things that were said in the videos, the original video cuts, and some of the original transcripts that ended up getting cut because the students, upon multiple reflections, felt like it wasn't true to their whole story, or it didn't feel safe to share that particular part of the story. And I cannot stress enough how important those pieces were. Own voice,
yeah.
Own language,
yeah.
Own English ability, owning your own story. How often do people get to do that? And the kids that we serve in particular, how often do people take the time to really listen to their story? So we had great IEG partnerships. This would not, I mean, it really took a village.
Yeah.
So Taya and her video team came and they recorded, and then a global pandemic happened and everything shut down. The fact that this book was published at all is a miracle and a testament to the will of the people involved that it got done, because things were so overwhelming. Everyone was, you know, everything was uncertain.
Yeah.
You know, we had no idea what was going to happen. And this could have been very easily let go.
Mm-hmm.
And no one would have judged anybody for it.
Right.
But the people involved were just, I mean, the dedication of the teachers, keeping track of the students, making
Right.
sure they were okay, being involved with them. Like, it's just, it is a miracle. And so we spent the bulk of the pandemic kind of going through the rest of the publication process.
Probably remotely, I'm
guessing.
Yes,
yeah, we did most of it remotely. And, you know, we have this gorgeous book now that features kids from all over the world. When I saw the original, my original students present at the Atlanta book, what struck me is that this is also the only published piece of material that I know that is written in developing English, and it's fine. So the mandate for the student volunteers that were working directly with students is that they did not change or correct their grammar or structure of English in any way, shape, or form. That they were only asking them questions for clarity purposes and getting their permission anytime a change was made. So it was based on what the students wanted.
How empowering is
that?
Oh
my God, right? And so when I saw the couple of students read their stories out loud in Atlanta, one of the young men stopped and he said, "I'm sorry, my English was way worse when I wrote this, so I'm just gonna paraphrase if that's okay." And like, of course it's okay, and you don't need to apologize. Like, this is a part of the whole learning process. So when teachers purchase Green Card Voices, they are purchasing a student-owned story, which is just, it's not something that we see.
Right.
So it's, we're very, very, very grateful and very lucky to have, you know, been able to, essentially my job was facilitator. So I did all of the nitty gritty organization, the sending the emails, the, you know, the behind the scenes, very, very unsexy stuff that has to happen, right?
Right.
In order
yeah.
to have a project like this.
Sure.
And honestly, it's been the honor of my life. Like, if I think about all of the things that I have done in this capacity as a professional development specialist, in my capacity as a teacher, this, the ability to elevate student voices, I think is the most important thing that I've done. And it's so rare, you know, we so rarely have an opportunity to be able to do that. And it has sparked some, you know, similar kind of storytelling things. So I know many teachers right now who even, you know, I think this was published in what, 2020 technically, or 2021? Let me find it. 2021, yep, first printing. So, you know, even almost 2 years later now, after the first printing of the set of books, there are teachers that are using stories as models for students they have. I'm working with a teacher right now who's just had a very large influx of students from Ukraine, and this is the text they're using in their standalone. And people have taken the prompts or similar prompts and kind of made their own school-wide books as a way to showcase what is happening in their community. And the book has influenced policy and decision-making in many, many places that it's published. I would like to mention that, you know, politics unfortunately plays a large role in what we do. And at the time of the publication of this book, two of the four schools that we worked with were closed because of the federal government's immigration policies. So the Bilingual Language and Literacy Academy closed, and those students were moved into other bilingual programs in Rochester City School District. And mid-school year, Buffalo Newcomer, the Lafayette Newcomer Academy in Buffalo, that has been around for years and years and years, didn't have enough students to support staying open. So they closed mid-school year. And those kids were either, those kids and teachers were either integrated into the Lafayette International High School, which is thankfully in the same building, or they were given a choice to move other places. But it's terribly sad. It's terribly sad. And so I think the need, the continued need to hear the stories of students and the resilience and the, you know, the what they want and why they're here is it's invaluable. And I think many of the issues about that we face and our role is kind of people who support programs and professional development in school districts. So the issues that we face with helping students get integrated and resistance to new populations and things like that would be solved if we could really think about these kids and their families as humans and what they and view them from a lens of what they have to offer our community, not what they're taking away from our community.
I was also thinking about when you said that teachers are using this text in their classrooms. Yeah. I mean, these are ENL classrooms, right? They're mm-hmm. using them in. But what a great idea would it be to use these in content area classrooms, mm-hmm. right?
I do know of one. One of my colleagues had a daughter in middle school, and she brought some text over to her social studies teacher and said, "Hey, maybe you could use this," and they ended up using it. But we do a lot of siloing our kids, and what would it be like if everyone read this? So as part of, we were still partially at home, we were only having hybrid schooling when this was published. And so normally when a book is published, we would have a big event where we would have all of the families come together and we would play the trailer, and kids who were comfortable would do a 30-second reading out loud, and we would have this whole huge celebration. And we weren't able to do that. We were able to, so I offered a if all Arburn Reads book clubs. So it was available to anyone in New York State who wanted to participate. Mm-hmm. And we reread this book collectively, and then they participated in discussion groups. And then the book launch was kind of the culminating activity for that book group. And it is the largest attended PD that we've had in the 10 years that I have worked at Auburn. So there was 122 participants in the book club, and they participated. You know, you expect when you're doing professional development some sort of attrition, right? So 30 people register, you might get 15 that totally complete something, right. Which is, you know, totally understandable. People have lives, people have things going on, there's competing issues at their job and with their families, and right. Everyone who registered for the course finished it. Wow. And the feedback we got was just phenomenal. And you know, I feel so grateful to have, you know, crossed paths with Taya and all of the students in this book. My goodness, my life is just exponentially better for knowing them. And I hope that when people read that, that is what they feel also, that, you know, that we're so lucky to have these students in our community.
And in addition to the book, the website has many of these stories there as well. The videos, right? In addition
yes.
to the text.
Yes. So the text is available both in physical and digital versions. Mm-hmm. And then every student who has a story published in the book also has a video to go along with that. So if you look in the pages of the book, there is a QR code to scan and watch the video of those students. So you can watch the video, and they're totally free to watch. You can watch the videos of the students, or you can read their stories. So it's really special.
And even the map that's there is, it's overwhelming just to see the number of countries that are represented.
Yes.
It's overwhelming.
Yes, it really is. And it's so interesting to think, like, oh, all of these people, like, everywhere in the world is essentially represented in our community. You don't always get a sense of that.
Yeah.
When you're just kind of living your day-to-day life and you're like, oh, I got to get gas, I got to run to the grocery store. And, you know, you don't know that unless you are involved in the community in a way that allows you to have contact with people from, you know, all over the world. So this was definitely, I can't stress enough how this was a partnership, mm-hmm. Between... a true partnership between students, teachers, institutions of higher ed, not-for-profit, publishing companies, and Auburns. Like, this would not have been done if all of these people didn't agree to put the work in. And
yeah.
And work it was. I mean, it was very uncertain for a while. It was very, you know, people kept being like, are we going to get this done? And I was like, yes, like I will do anything I have to do to make sure that this gets done. And I'm so grateful that everyone who was a part of the team felt that way, that they were willing to do whatever they needed to do to make sure that these student voices got heard.
And I know you, obviously one of the biggest challenges for you was dealing with COVID.
Yeah.
Were there other challenges, you know, maybe bureaucratic or mm-hmm. administrational challenges that might be?
Yes. And I assumed that the challenge would actually be to begin with the money. You know, gathering the money to publish a book is no small feat.
Mm-hmm.
And because all of this happened in COVID generally, it's my understanding that what happens is a place is chosen, the stories are told, the book trailer is put together, and then businesses and organizations kind of are like, take my money, right? Like, take my money. Oh. We want to see this project finished. Mm-hmm. And
that's amazing.
That wasn't our story. So I assumed that was going to be the most challenging part, but I actually think the most challenging part was keeping track of the students after everything shut down.
Yeah.
So after they went home, and you know, were they answering emails? Were they returning phone calls? Could we get a hold of them on Facebook? We were so all of the students were consulted in the publication process, but we have lost contact with one of the students. He moved back to Puerto Rico. He was available for the book launch, but we haven't heard from him since. And I still have his book. I would love to give it to him. I think that is the hardest, was the hardest part. And I think how the book was launched was a little bit of a, like, we're so happy that it's done, but being online together is not the same as in person. And I would have loved to have been in a room with the families of those students to see how proud their parents were of them. So actually, one of the students in the book from Buffalo, Immaculate, her grandmother is the oldest resettled refugee in the United States.
Wow.
I don't know if she's still living, but if you Google, like, you Immaculate's grandmother will come up in the Buffalo News.
Wow.
I just was dreaming of meeting Immaculate's grandmother. Like, we did do a small in-person book launch at the end of last school year. In conjunction with a lovely independent bookstore we have here in Rochester called Hippocampal Books. It's owned by a retired bilingual education teacher. It's in my neighborhood. They're lovely. Henry's a really great guy to work with. And he was able to order books in the store. And we had the event catered by a former English language learner who owned a baking company now, and
wow.
We had it outside of the park. And so some of the students were able to read in front of their families, and some people were able to attend. But I am a little sad that it wasn't the large event that we really were hoping that it would be. And now, you know, most of the kids, not all of them, but most of the kids that participated in the book were in their late high school years. So they've moved on. They've gone to college. So having access to the students now is really hard.
Right.
They're kind of, the two that are left that are still, they're like 11th graders, they're kind of talked out because they're the ones that we asked to do all the events. So they
yeah.
have presented. So we've presented with student panels at New York State TESOL, at NABE, the National Association for Bilingual Education, and Taya's presented before at International TESOL. And then we presented last year at a SIFE conference that was done by Inlier Learning out of Philadelphia.
Okay.
So Taya was one of the sponsors, and every person who attended that conference, there were about 250 virtual attendees, received a book. They received this book, actually. So the reach is wide, even though, you know, the process was difficult and the actual launching wasn't what it typically is. I feel whenever I look at this book, I always think about how many people that I don't know that are reading it, or how many students that I don't, you know, that will be impacted by these stories.
Yeah, the reach of that is just, it's unfathomable.
Yeah, and something that they normally do for books and we just weren't able to pull off due to COVID restrictions and cost was those banners. Usually, so they're very large banners, and there's one for every student that gets made with their face and a quote and a QR code. And normally, they are part of the sort of publication process,
right.
And they are housed in a library typically. So they are public property that anyone can check out and set an exhibition up for. And we just haven't been able to do that. So none of the students in this book have banners. You know, it's something that we've kind of batted around about whether or not that's something we need to do. And if we do, because we're multi-region, who would house it and how would we take care of that? And so that's a problem we just haven't been able to solve. So I do know Taya is in the process of publishing another Green Card Voices volume now. I can Wow. look up and see how many actual books she's published.
Yeah. Do not see any emails. Oh, wait, she did. Oh, let's see. My last super important meeting went late and I didn't realize it. I'm available from now for another hour. Please reach out if you want to do the recording.
Yeah, tell her to hop on.
Yeah. Okay, let me just reply back. Oops, a little bit formatting here.
I actually have to hop off.
Right.
Now, so it actually works.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's like, I don't know. She'll be able to tell you how many. But thank you for doing this. I hope this gets lots of listens and more books are published and more people get to hear the kids' stories.
Yeah.
In the show notes, do you like put the link to the website or the book trailer or anything?
Yep, I will do all of that. Oh yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
perfect.
Absolutely. Now, before you go, can you just like, because I need to introduce you somehow.
Oh so yeah, of
you
course.
Just say, you know, just introduce yourself and you know, what your role is and
sure,
how
sure.
you're working with owls and stuff. Okay.
Sure. So my name is Jennifer Rapponi. I work for the Midwest Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network. I'm housed in BOCES, right outside of Rochester, New York. And I've been doing this job for 10 years now. Prior to that, I was a K-12 ESL teacher in a rural school. And that really became my passion. So I went to undergrad for communicative disorders and sciences. I was a speech therapist for a little while. And as part of my clinical hours, I was assigned students that were in the international program. And my goal was to work with them toward their English goals. So practicing job interviews, working on long and short vowel sounds, pronunciation, which we used to call accent reduction back in the day, and we do not
Oh,
do
yes.
that or call that anymore.
Right.
So I went to a SUNY Geneseo, and my building was right on the quad. And because I knew all of these international students, and I also happened to live in an international dorm, I would walk on the quad, and people that like did not know that I did not know that were part of the international program would be like, like waving. It was really great. And so I started my career as a speech therapist, and I felt like I learned a lot of things really quickly. And then if you know about first language acquisition, we know all the things. We know how it works.
Yep.
It is very rote. It is very prescripted. And I didn't feel like I was being challenged enough. And I was trying to decide what to get my master's in. And I was thinking about back when I enjoyed being a speech therapist the most, and it was working with international students. And so I am very passionate about social justice and educational equity. So I sought out a master's program that focused on both second language acquisition and social justice. So I attended the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester. And the rest is sort of history. I was really lucky enough in my first position to build a program that did what was best for kids. I was given the leeway and the trust and the opportunity to do that by some really great administrators. And that led me to this job. I actually met my former boss in the process of building that program. And when a position came open, she said, "I think you're perfect for it." And I was not ready to leave the classroom. I had no other aspirations besides being a teacher for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And the opportunities and the amount of students I've been able to impact from moving to the classroom to this job is just, it's uncountable, really. Because of projects like this, right? I
Right.
know what the project was.
Yep.
I can guess at the impact, I don't have a full understanding of how this will change people's lives. And I'm eternally grateful for the opportunity.
You probably will never know, but
yeah,
it's really amazing. And thank you for your dedication and all of your work. It has been a pleasure to talk with you and to listen to your story and all of your work with Green Card Voices. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was lovely.
Yes, you're welcome. I will talk to you soon.
Bye. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.